Hello, everyone. A little more than 4 years ago, my wife and I moved to Strongsville. We sold our big old Lakewood house where things kept falling off it with alarming regularity and moved to a house that wasn't terribly old, about 30 years old, broken in, I would say. I like our house. It's not very big. I think you would call it modest. I tried taking a picture of it to show some friends of ours when we moved, but you can't really take a picture of our house. Our house looks like a garage from the street. There's nothing special about the architecture, and if you drive down our street, the houses all look the same. Some people on our street call it the barracks. They were built that way, and it looks like all the rest. But it was a nice layout. We were looking for a one-level place. Our previous house was a lot of stairs, and at the time I was having some knee troubles that thankfully are a thing of the past. Also, it was much nearer my work. There were reasons to do it. And they mow the grass there for us, and they plow the snow in the wintertime, and every 6 years or so, the outside gets painted as part of being there. But when we moved there, it didn't occur to me, because I'd never been in that kind of situation, that if you get that kind of services, it means you're part of a homeowners association. And it was very clear. I mean, it said in the real estate listings that it was part of a homeowners association, but I didn't really understand what that entailed. And to make a long story short, if you know me at all, you know that I'm constantly complaining about our homeowners association. I was tricked, and I think that is the right word. That's not just a bad attitude. It's partly a bad attitude on my part, but we are in our 60s, and that makes us junior citizens on the street. There's people in their 80s and 90s, and when someone who can still walk moves in, people start saying, "Ooh, get them on the board, you know, get them," because they can actually walk around the development. And seriously, there are quite a number of people in our development who can't walk very far from their house. And I wanted to wait till I retired, which is still a few years out, because you really need some time to devote to that kind of thing if you're going to do it well. But a year ago, it was suggested that I be on the board. There was the president at the time was really stressed out and having some specific problems, and she asked me if I would be on the board, and I said yes. Well, the idea is you get on the board, and you serve on the board first as a board member, and then you serve as vice president, and then you serve as president, and then you go to your reward, which is you just get to sit on your deck after that, and other people do the work. But I showed up to my first board meeting, and I should have known by the smiles of people when I was elected. And the other two people looked at me and said, "We're not being president." And I said, "Well, of course you are." And they said, "No, we're not. You are." And I said, "Well, I don't want to be." And they said, "Well, we're going to take a vote." And there were three of us. And I thought to myself, I could get out of this right now, or I could make them regret this by doing things and making the board do things and things. Anyway, you know, we in the church, we're service-oriented. We should be. It's part of our makeup after a while. And again, we should be. That's the way Jesus Christ is. But I am about halfway through my term as Homeowners Association president, and it's a very stressful thing for me. It's not something that's natural for me. It's not something that I always enjoy doing. I like living on this street, and I like our house, and I keep reminding myself of that kind of thing. But I get together with a fellow every week and play hammer dulcimer, and we, besides playing hammer dulcimer, we talk a lot. And he, I don't know why he does this, but he always asks, "Well, how's the Homeowners Association?" He knows I don't want him to ask that. But he used to be president of the college, so he knows about stress from being in a government position, so to speak. And his question to me is, "Well, why do you do it?" And I sit there and I think, I don't know. Why do I do it? I ask myself that all the time. Well, I want to talk about things that have to do with that at this point. Being on a homeowners association, although it's small, we have 40 houses. It's like a glorified student council. There might be 60 people, 60-some, I would say, in the development. There's one or two people in most of the houses. And it should not be that hard, except that we have very accomplished, very determined, very stubborn people on our street who want things to be a certain way, not necessarily the way that the rules are. And so it does take a bit of governing. But government, I'm learning, means different things than what I might have thought it meant decades ago. God's way of life has a lot to do with government, both now and in the future, his whole plan. You've heard probably, some of you are fairly new to God's way of life, some of you have been around for decades, multiple decades, and in your church experience, you have heard, you have read articles, you've heard programs, you've heard sermons presented with a title, Prepare to be a King, or something similar to that. As a matter of fact, if you go to the United Church of God website and type in, search, Prepare to be a King, a very fine article will come up, a very relevant, important article with very good scriptures and very good points. So it's still a current topic. Prepare to be a king. It's part of what we do. It may sound old-fashioned, it may sound a little trite, but it's still should be a big part of our outlook. As I said, you've heard sermons about it, you've read articles, but you've also heard sermons and articles, not so many lately, but in the olden days, which means before Ronald Reagan, you would often hear articles on the correct form of government, very vehement articles on what is the correct form of government. And it usually involves the person giving the sermon being in charge at that point. But government is very important. We know that in Isaiah 9, talking about the wonderful world tomorrow, the good side of God's plan, the part that we're really, really looking forward to, that part of the description of Jesus Christ's reign is that of his government, of the increase of his government, there will be no end. So there will always be government with us, and it will grow and grow and grow, and it will always be important. There are many aspects to government, and it isn't just taking an iron rod and dashing nations to pieces. Government involves teaching. Government involves judging. The reason I know this is if you turn to Isaiah 9, which we will, it says all these things. That's part of the increase of his government. In Isaiah 9, wonderful, wonderful scriptures that I turn to often when I need some uplifting, starting in verse 6. It says, for unto us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. He will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God. This is all part of government. Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness. Teaching, judging, settling disputes are part of all this. It's interesting that in Isaiah, also in other parts of Isaiah, it talks about the fact that what is not being taught at that point is training for war, that swords will be turned into plowshares. And although, you know, there will be swords and wars when Jesus Christ first returns because he has to conquer the earth, after that, it's a different kind of governing. It involves teaching, judging, settling disputes. In God's kingdom, we will be governing. We know that our reward is termed to us both by the Apostle Paul and in the book of Revelation as a crown. A crown is something we want. It's not the absolute end, but a crown is something that we want to achieve. In a way, it's a beginning. It's a way that we can help God in ways that we couldn't do it before. Mr. Thomas was reading to us in the book of Daniel, the last couple sermons. If you'll turn to Daniel 7, a part that he was talking about, Daniel 7, and actually it mentions this twice in that chapter, but we'll look at Daniel 7 and verse 27, when the world's governments are at their end and Jesus Christ returns and establishes his way of life. In Daniel 7 and verse 27, it says, then the sovereignty, which means rulership, sovereignty, power, and greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven, because the the King of Kings has just come and conquered the world, will be handed over to the saints. That's us, to the people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. In Revelation 5 and verse 10, it echoes a verse in Revelation 1. In Revelation 5 and 10, this is one of those verses that we learn early on because it's an important part of our plan. In Revelation 5 and verse 10, it says, "You have made them," that's men, "you have made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God." And in the King James Version, it says, "made to be kings and priests." So there's more than one thing we do. We don't just teach people and lead them in God's way of life, but we also rule. And if, you know, many of the translations have that, "you have made them to be a kingdom," but then following that, it says, "they will reign on earth." So whatever your choice of words is, it's people who are going to be reigning and people who are going to be governing. It's kind of fun to me that when we think about the reward of the saved, when we think about our reward in the world tomorrow, it never seems to involve work, does it? And it's not just in our outlook. I mean, if you look at the mythologies of other religions that don't make a lot of sense, but they're well known, you know, you go to heaven and you loaf all day, or you go to a reward and you spend time with beautiful young women or people fanning you or bringing you wonderful food. But it never involves work, does it? It's like a Jane Austen novel. No one really does anything. They all just sit around and enjoy things. But we will actually be working. Now, part of the reward, of course, does involve enjoying the good things that God gives us. I mean, one of the pictures that symbolizes the world tomorrow is every man sitting under his vine and fig tree in abundance, living in peace and unafraid. And that involves taking time to enjoy the good things that God will give us. So there will be a lot of that. And, you know, there are even a couple places in the Gospels, the story of Jesus' life, where he makes it very clear that taking a break is important. There's times when the disciples, after doing some work, after being sent out, get to enjoy a little vacation on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. Or Jesus will take a break and take some time out. That does happen. So that's something that Jesus acknowledges, that we do need that kind of thing. But for the 1,000 years when Jesus is here and then after God returns, we will also be working. We will be helping God make this the world that it was always meant to be, and a world that's so good that we can't even imagine it. What is government? Well, my concept of that has changed over the years. I am in my 60s, and frankly, I am probably about, judging by the time that my family seems to live, I'm about 3/4 of the way along with my life. Now, that may sound like a morbid approach, but it's actually very practical. I mean, you kind of plan for things like, well, how many cars am I going to have to buy? Let's see, one roof should do me. One air conditioning unit, yeah, that's fine. It'll be around here when my children sell the house. Will the parrot have died? I'm really not sure about that one. But I think I started thinking in terms of the time that I have left. But it's also changed my approach towards people and family and what's important. Because I realize that I'm not going to be around forever, and the things that I was so sure of, I'm not so sure of anymore. And so my concept of government, and this is not a definition that is original to me, but it's a definition that I like very much, and it differs from the way I would have defined it years and years ago. And I would love to argue with you about the appropriateness of this. I think it's what government is. Government is a form of organization that helps people do together what they cannot do alone. That's what I truly believe, that the reason we have government, that the reason we have to have a homeowners association is so that we can do things that benefit us all together. You can live without a homeowners association. Many of you do. I did for most of my life. It can be done. But a government helps people do together what they cannot do alone. God acknowledged this, you know, at the time of the Tower of Babel. You know the story very well, but mankind was working together. And there was a form of government. We're not real sure what it was, but people didn't just say, oh, I'll bring a brick, see if somebody else brings a brick, maybe we can build something. No, there were plans to build a tower. There was a world organization at that point, and even God acknowledged at that point that people can pretty much do whatever they put their minds to. They're quite capable of it. It's amazing. And so for reasons of his own, he threw a wrench in that. He changed the languages and made it more difficult for people to actually work together. But just by acknowledging that he had to find ways to help people not work together, it shows what can be done when people do work together. And so to me, government is, as I said, a form of organization that helps us do together what we cannot do alone. And it's not just people. It actually helps beings do together. And I use the word beings because there are things God can't do as well as humans can. And that may sound like blasphemy to you, but if that's not true, why bother? Why make human beings if there's not something that they can do that God can't do? And of course, one of the things that we can do is we can relate to other human beings. We can be on earth and do things that God chooses not to do at this point. The earth, God pretty much leaves us alone. The earth is pretty much up to us at this point. And there's things that we can do organizationally. There's things that we can accomplish with various talents, with various ways of building, with various art forms, with families, with love, with all kinds of things. There's things that we can do that God and Jesus Christ couldn't do when it was just them existing. There's a reason that there's a human race. Otherwise, why would he have made us? In the church, we talk about, again, you've heard sermons that there's a right form of church government. And yet, you know, it seems to me that when you read the New Testament, that there might even be more than one form of government. And like I said, I would love to argue about that with you. I'd be very happy to. I'm armed. But that's not what this message is about today. But I would propose that in a church government, any form of government where children of God are striving to carry out God's will and are led by God's commandments and his Holy Spirit is a good form of government. You know, United has been criticized that we're not a one very strong ruler at the top form of government, that we have a council and that we have a president. And there have been quite a few arguments about that, and some people have said they couldn't be part of United because it wasn't the right form of government. Well, all I can say is it seems to be working just fine, that people can do that kind of thing. If they're led by God's Holy Spirit and they approach God and they pray and they're humble and they do their best to find out what God wants to do, that's the right form of church government. And actually, if you look through the Bible, God himself established different forms of government. There doesn't seem to be much going on at the very beginning when Adam and Eve were there. But by the time of Abraham, the form of government seemed to be a family, seemed to be tribes. I mean, Abraham was able to muster an army and win some battles, but it was mostly his family and his servants. It was the business that he ran. It was the society that, if you want to say, he was president of. Later, God had judges who ruled over Israel, and he actually established royalty. He established a king. But the funny thing was, if you recall, when God established a king, he said, "This isn't the way I want it." Which is a very strange thing to do. Why would God establish a form of government that he doesn't really want? Well, there was a reason for it at the time. The people were asking for it. There were things going on that made God do it. And he let it happen. And God loved some of the kings of Israel. When Saul started out, God loved Saul. God did very wonderful things for Saul. David was one of God's best friends. So God worked through kings and had a wonderful relationship with them. Sometimes there were prophets who were in charge. Later on, after the nation had returned from captivity, there was a council in charge. As the church goes on, in some places there are elders in charge, and yet in other places, in Jerusalem, it seemed like there was a governing body called a council in charge. So there seems to be some variation, but in the right form of church government, what characterizes is that people are striving, led by God's Holy Spirit, to carry out God's will, to obey the commandments that they've been given, and to fulfill the job that they've been given to do, to preach the gospel. As a matter of fact, any time that I hear an organization ranting about the need to submit to God's government, I think to myself, well, they're in trouble. Because that means that people are starting to think, well, I don't have to submit to God's government, do I? And so the hammer has to fall. It is important to submit to God's government. I don't want to say that it's not. If you turn to Ezekiel, this is in the millennium. Ezekiel in chapter 44, We were talking about these verses a week or two ago, in that it's difficult to understand all that's going on here. But in Ezekiel 44, it talks about priests in the world tomorrow, and that'll be one of the roles that we carry out. Ezekiel 44 and verse 24, it says, and this is talking about things that happen in any dispute. So there's going to be disagreements even in the world tomorrow. People who think that something should be done one way or something should be done their way. That's what a dispute is. You want to do it your way, I want to do it my way. Well, the priests are going to serve as judges and decide it according to my ordinances. I'm reading scripture now. They are to keep my laws and my decrees for all my appointed feasts, and they are to keep my Sabbaths holy. So I am not saying that we don't need to submit to God's laws and government. We do. But I'm saying that if you hear that ranted about, that it gives you pause. Because as much as possible, if I understand what God is doing, his government gets carried out by people who are serving as friends and equals. And one example that I can give you is the example of marriage, because marriage is a very small unit of government, marriage or family. And we know from the teachings of Paul and from things that Jesus Christ himself said, that in a marriage, the husband is the head of the union. But we're submit to each other, we're to love each other. The husband is to love the wife as Christ loves the church. The wife is to submit to the husband as the church submits to Jesus Christ. But if you're ever around a marriage where the husband is playing, I'm head of this marriage and we're going to do it my way, he's right, but you kind of know that things are in trouble at that point, that things aren't working out. And the marriages that I've most admired are the marriages where that kind of thing isn't necessary, because good government has to do with good leadership. And in a good marriage, the husband and wife work together as a team, and they can talk about things, and they can discuss things, and they can present their differences of opinion, and they can agree on something, and they can decide to do it. And then there are occasions where a decision might have to be made, and something would have to be overruled, and that's why there is that form of leadership. That's why there is that form of authority given. But I would say that the very best marriages are the ones between friends and equals, where they acknowledge that that form of government exists, but they don't have to use it. And we know that we're to be servants. In Luke 22, Jesus Christ is chiding his disciples because they've been arguing about who is the greatest at this point. It's very near the time when Jesus is going to die, and here's the disciples arguing. But in Luke 22, he leaves some last words with them and so with us that are very, very important. Luke 22 and verse 24, also a dispute arose among them as to which of them was considered to be the greatest. Jesus said to them, the kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors. And that's the form of government that people most often think of. But in verse 26, Jesus says, you are not to be like that. Instead, the greatest among you should be like the youngest, and the one who rules like the one who serves. For who is greater, the one who is at table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who is at table? But I am among you as one who serves. You are those who have stood by me in my trials. In other words, he loves them and they're his friends. And they will, he says that they will eventually judge the 12 tribes of Israel. And yet, his form of rulership is serving. If you recall, that was the night that he washed their feet. And that's why we do it, because that form of serving in government, in our organization, should be a built-in part of it. And observing that ritual of washing each other's feet is a symbol, but it also helps build into our personalities that kind of service, and that is very, very important. You know, there's the example of David and how he led his men. If you recall, he was much beloved by Israel and beloved by his army. He didn't rule just by fear. You'll probably remember the story. It's in 2 Samuel where David was fighting a battle and he just offhand said, oh, I wish I had a drink of water from the well in Jerusalem. And they went up to the town, his soldiers, and risked their lives to get him a drink of water because they loved him that much. When they brought it back to him, he poured it out. As a symbol, he said, no, these men's lives are too valuable. I can't do that. But he was just beloved, and that's the way he was a king, and he ruled, but he was also a friend of God, and he had those people's friendship and love. There's, of course, the example of Jesus serving all the time and washing people's feet and feeding them and healing them. And although when he comes back, he will have to conquer the world with a rod of iron, then after that, it becomes more a matter of shepherding. I remember a lesson that I learned a long time ago, and I've tried to apply it now, but this actually happened back when I was in the Forest Service, and I'm not making this up. I was in the town of Canoe Gulch, Montana. That's where I was in the summer of 1975. My dad said, "Where do you find these towns?" Because before then, I lived in one called Happy's Inn, which was named after the bar on the south side of the road. They had had a choice of naming it after the bar on the south side of the road or the bar on the north side of the road. And thankfully, Happy's Inn won. And I say thankfully because the bar on the north side of the road was called the Twinkle Toes Inn. And no one wanted to live in Twinkle Toes, but I lived in Happy's Inn for a while. But there I was in Canoe Gulch, and I had my degree from forestry school, and I'd worked for the Forest Service for a year or two, and I was made a crew boss. And a young man came up from the college. He was working there in the summer, and he was a fine young person. I really regret that this happened. I had to work with him the entire summer, and he was fun, and he worked hard, and he sang. He was good looking. He was he knew how to do all kinds of things because he grew up on a farm, so he was used to machinery, and he was used to getting a lot of work done, period. He would have just been the absolute ideal person to work with, but when I met him, we were at a table in the kitchen, and I said, "Oh, hi, I'm going to be your boss this summer." And he resented me from that moment on. If I had said, "Hi, I'm Mark, we're working together," it might have been completely different. It took me a while to figure that out. I didn't even realize the mistake that I had made. But after a few times when he said, "Oh, well, you're the boss," I kind of got the message, you know, at that point. And now when I come up to people, like if I have to solve a problem in the homeowners association, I don't say, "Hi, I'm Mark Graham, I'm the president of the board." Number one, that doesn't mean anything, you know. So what? But I say, "Oh, hi, I'm your neighbor." And I try to think of ways, like there was a man who was parking his boat in the street for a period of time, and you're not supposed to do that, but he did it. He said everyone did it, but no one has ever parked a boat in the street other than him, as far as I know. And I knew I was going to have to go over and talk to him about parking his boat in the street. And I actually prayed about it, because this man's kind of a cantankerous guy. I'd had dealings with him before, and he's one of these people who likes to do things his way. In other words, a normal human being. And I went over to him, and I said, "Hey, is this a new boat?" And we talked about his boat for a while. And then after a while, he said, "You know I shouldn't have this in the street." I said, "And I have to be the one who comes over and says something about it." And we talked about it, and we actually parted as friends, and he moved his boat. And it worked out. I wish they all worked out that way. It doesn't always. As you know, I am a piano player. I play for a lot of singers. And I have a hero who's a piano player who plays for world-class singers named Roger Vignoles. He's a superb musician, but also a very amusing personality. And he said that sometimes he describes the art of accompanying, well, here's the exact quote, "I sometimes describe it as the art of getting what you want without the other person noticing." In other words, the soprano sings on, and you think, "This is going slower than I think it ought to." And so you just kind of ease into it, you know, and the soprano looks at you, and you just kind of go, "Must be you." And but there's ways to do it. And in a way, that has a lot to do with good government. I sometimes describe it as the art of getting what you want without the other person noticing. And there are ways to do that. But we do have some clues. If you turn to Jeremiah 3 and verse 15, this talks about a time after the world has been destroyed and it's going to be rebuilt again. But the nations have been conquered at this point, and the world is in a terrible mess. And we're jumping right into it, but in Jeremiah 3, in verse 15, it says, "Then I will give you shepherds after my own heart." This is a description of the way that we'll be leading. "I will give you shepherds after my own heart who will lead you with knowledge and understanding. In those days when your numbers have increased greatly in the land, men will no longer say," well, they won't talk about the old things. It's like Mr. Scapura said, they will forget those things. But they it's if you follow down to the end of verse 17, it says, no longer will they follow the stubbornness of their evil hearts. The important part is that we will lead with knowledge and understanding. And in Isaiah 30, there's a verse that is kind of fun to think about. And I know you know this verse. And when I was new in the church, I thought this was very cool. Because it is. And in Isaiah 30 and 30, verse 20 and 21, it talks about the role of teachers in the world tomorrow. And the role that we'll be serving. And our brothers and sisters, some who have lived many years before us, and some who are yet to even be called to God's way of life, but we'll all be serving in this way. Isaiah 30, verses 20 and 21, talking about teachers. Although the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, and there's specific reasons for that at that time, your teachers will be hidden no more. With your own eyes, you will see them. So we'll be spirit beings at that point, but we'll still be able to relate to human beings as human beings in a way that God couldn't do. God would walk up and say, hi, I'm president of the Homeowners Association. No, he wouldn't, but I mean, it would be that kind of thing. Whereas these people will say, I'm your brother and your sister and your friend. And we will say, whether you turn to the right or left, your ears will hear a voice behind you saying, this is the way, walk in it. So they will have teachers who will teach them, and it will be a form of governing. It will be, as Roger Vignoli said, the art of getting what we want, but it will also be helping them. It'll be the way that God does things. Here's how we know that preparing to be a king and preparing to rule is important, because Jesus says it is. If you turn to Luke and verse 19, there's a very famous parable, and he gave this parable more than once. This was a parable that he taught to various groups of people whenever it needed to be taught. It's the parable of the pounds. In my Bible, it says the 10 minas, which is a unit of money. In my Bible, the note says a mina was about 3 months' wages. The important thing is, it's a large sum of money. It's a chunk. And the parable begins in verse 12 of Luke 19. A man of noble birth went to a distant country to have himself appointed king and then to return. Not too hard to figure out who that refers to. So he called 10 of his servants and gave them 10 minas. Put this money to work, he said, until I come back. Well, the story goes on. Anyway, he came back, and down in verse 15, then he sent for the servants to whom he had given the money in order to find out what they had gained with it. The first one came and said, sir, your mina has earned 10 more. Well done, my good servant, his master replied. Now, this person has been given a sum of money, and he's used it apparently in business or some way that we don't know. But he's used it in a way that his reward is a very strange reward, if I may say so. I mean, it doesn't seem like it would fit. If I give you a bunch of money and you increase it and it earns much more money and you come to me and say, look what I did with the money, I would say, I'm putting you in charge of my money. But that's not what the master says here. The master here says in verse 17, because you have been trustworthy in a very small matter, take charge of 10 cities. What? I mean, you know, there's another version of this parable in Matthew where it's called the parable of the talents. And our word talent has been twisted a little bit. Talent is just a unit of money like a mina is. But we think that talent means something like being able to dance ballet or play the piano or write a book or something like that. We're photography. You know, talent to us is that kind of thing. But talent really was just a sum of money, like a mina. And again, he gives a reward based on that. And we often interpret that as, well, God gives you gifts, God gives you abilities, and then you're going to be rewarded according to that. Well, I play the piano, and I play the piano pretty good. It's what I do. You have things that you do very well. I play the piano. So in the world tomorrow, is God going to come up to you and say, well done, Marco, you play the piano. 10 cities for you. That doesn't happen. All right, it did happen in 1919 when the pianist Jan Paderewski was made the prime minister of Poland, but that was an entirely different story. A very interesting man, by the way. He has a walk on the Hollywood Star of Fame. And because he was a celebrity, and because he was a world figure, and because Poland was being organized as a country at that point, they really did use a piano player to organize the nation. just like a homeowners association, he did his bit and then got out of there as fast as he could and moved somewhere else. But ignore Paderewski. I'm sorry I brought it up. It was a diversion. We're back to Luke 19. And whatever these people have been doing, they've been doing it in a way where they learned enough about government that they were going to handle cities. And if you go down, one person earns five more minas, and so that person gets five cities. So these people, in some way, and it doesn't mean that they were homeowners association presidents, it could be that they ran a business. And a business is a form of government, if you think of a business as being something that organizes people so that they can do together what they can't do alone. It could also be working in a neighborhood. It could be working in a school. It could be having a family. It could be in a PTA. It could be volunteering. It could be a professional organization. It could be anything where you have to take resources and help people do things with it. And that's what these people did, and that's why they were rewarded with cities. The reward is government, being able to govern. You're going to do people a favor. Now, if you said to me, in the world tomorrow, you're going to be in charge of a homeowners association for the rest of your life, which is basically what this is, I would just dive into an ocean. I don't know what I would do at that point. I mean, that sounds horrible to me. But this is a whole different setup, and I'm dealing with surly, if I may use the word, worldly, Mr. Thomas said I can't talk politics, so I will not. But anyway, they are people who I find it very difficult to get along with sometimes. Whereas this is in God's government. This will be a place where we want to rule because we'll be doing what we were born to do at that point. But the point is that these people spent their lives learning, preparing for how to do that kind of ruling, how to rule cities. And, you know, the increase of his government won't end. So they might start with 10 cities, but they might be in charge of a lot more than that by the time they get done. We need to govern now in this age. If we're going to prepare to be kings, when we are provided with opportunities, we should consider taking them because they make us better children of God. It can be something as blatant as a homeowners association. I hope you never end up in one. But many of you are already in situations where you're learning that kind of cooperation and that kind of learning with dealing with people. And we should take advantage of those opportunities. We should thank God for them, and we should glorify in them. And if we don't, that's not the end of the parable. I don't know if you remember, but if you go down to verse 20, there was another servant. And the servant said, "Sir, here is your mina. I have kept it laid away in a piece of cloth. I was afraid of you because you are a hard man. You take out what you did not put in and reap what you did not sow." His master replied, "I will judge you by your own words, you wicked servant. You knew, did you, that I am a hard man, taking out what I did not put in and reaping what I did not sow. Then why didn't you put my money on deposit so that when I came back I could have collected it with interest?" And he said, "Take his mina away from him and give it to the one who has 10 minas. "Sir," they said, "he already has 10. And he replied, "I tell you that to everyone who has, more will be given. But as for the one who has nothing, even what he has will be taken away." So if I pass up opportunities that are given to me, it doesn't mean I can't pass some up, because I will. But I have to take some of those opportunities because I have to grow more like God. They can come in many forms, as I said, and you have to find your own in this world. And I'm not saying you have to run for president. There are situations where people in our church have been on school boards, where it makes sense to be on school boards, where it really affects how their children will do in school. And sometimes that makes sense. There are situations where it makes sense not to be on the school board. I totally agree with that. But we all have to find what's in our own lives, and we have to face it. Has the Homeowners Association working in it made me a better person? Well, no, not yet. It really hasn't. I'm not very good at it. I dodge things. I'm not very good at working with people. I don't deal with problems head on, but I'm learning. As I said to one neighbor who's a friend, I said, I'm learning this one crisis at a time. I make so many mistakes, and I've turned some people off, but I'm learning. I'm learning how to face challenges. I'm learning not to let problems sit. I'm learning how to deal with people. I do make mistakes, but I keep those mistakes in mind the next time a situation comes up. And there will be no end of situations. Thankfully, as I said, it's like a glorified student council, and none of it is all that important. It's just living on a street. That's all it is. But what is important and what is true is that God needs us to be able to govern. He needs us to be able to govern, not just him and Jesus Christ. Because after Jesus returns, he's going to need people to work with wounded people. People will be in a terrible frame of mind. Their lives will be destroyed. They'll have seen their families destroyed in many cases. Their whole livelihood, their food, their farms, their businesses, everything that they knew as a given will be gone at that point. The world will be in a terrible fix. And there will have to be not just resurrected people who can work with people, but there will also have to be flesh and blood people who can work with people, who can do the building and the leading and the burying and the growing and the crops and things like that. And we'll have to organize those people. Someone will. It will be a thrill to do it because we'll be doing what God wants, and we'll have Jesus Christ on earth to tell us what he wants. There won't be any doubt about it. And it will be backed up with authority, yes. But mostly we will be teaching and judging and helping and encouraging. When you think about it, the world is really just a big homeowners association. It just depends on whose home you're talking about. The problem is that mankind's survival is at stake in that one, whereas it's just 40 houses on my street. Also, the world has better architecture than our street has. But to be more like God, I will continue to be on the homeowners association for one more year. And then I'm going to quit and get out of there and move on to something else. But my goal is to become like God, and I have to say that doing this kind of thing makes me think in those terms and makes me more like God. I mean, that's the goal, isn't it, for all of us? And like I said, you have to find your own ways to do that kind of thing. If you turn to Matthew 25 and 23, this is right in the middle of that parable of the talents. Matthew 25 and 23, and this is a verse that resonates with all of us. It's a verse that we learn early on. And it's a verse that we keep in our minds. You know what verse I keep in my mind is? If any of you have seen Finding Dory, I go through my day going, just keep swimming, just keep swimming. Well, there's, of course, many of God's verses that resonate in our minds. And this is one. This is one that should be memorized. This is our goal. Matthew 25 and verse 23. Then the master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. We are servants. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. And in this parable, he doesn't name the number of cities. That's a little bit different. But he puts us in charge of many things. So we will be in the government at that point. But then he says, this master, who obviously symbolizes Jesus Christ, then the master says, come and share your master's happiness. Well, look at that. It's about happiness. Government isn't just about ruling. It's also about happiness. There really is no end to the wonders of God's government.